The first reading this morning comes from the memoirs of the late and great American novelist John Updike, who died this last Tuesday. John Updike grew up his first 13 years in the small Pennsylvania town of Shillington, and here he describes that town with something of the eye of a painter.
Toward the end of Philadelphia Avenue, beside the park that surrounds the town hall, I turned and looked back up the straight sidewalk in the soft evening gloom, looking for what the superstitious old people of the country used to call a sign. The pavement squares, the house fronts, the remaining trees receded in silence and shadow. I loved this plain street, where for 13 years no great harm had been allowed to befall me. I loved Shillington, not as one loves Capri or New York because they are special, but as one loves one's own body and consciousness because they are synonymous with being. It was exciting for me to be in Shillington, as if my life, like the expanding universe, when projected backwards, gained heat and intensity. If there was meaning to existence, I was closest to it here.
The second reading also comes from a memoir from the wonderful American Buddhist writer Natalie Goldberg.
Thank God for that rain out the window and for Mr. Clemente, who allowed us in ninth grade to listen to it for no reason in the middle of the day. That one moment carried me a long way into my life. I didn't know it then. At the time, I think it made me a little nervous. It was too naked, too uncontrolled, too honest. I thought it odd. In those days, I was watching my step, making sure I knew the rules, keeping things in control. I wore the same long pleated skirt every day, blue cardigan sweater and Oxford shoes, and carried a brown leather school bag, even while the other girls were wearing makeup, nylons, heels. I never felt that I fit in, for fear that people would think I was weird. I saw no one around me I could identify with. I tried not to be noticed. I became a nerd. And there was Mr. Clemente, who asked me to listen to the rain, to connect a sense organ with something natural, neutral, good. He asked me to become alive. I was scared, and I loved it.
Super Bowl Sunday. 20 years ago, this would have been the last day in the church year when Frank Perry would be absent from the Sunday service. I'm speaking of my former congregation in California, where Frank was a beloved member. Every year, without fail, when football season would begin in the fall, he would come up to me and utter the same ritual phrase, "See you in early February." As you know, there are three major loves in my life. I love my wife, I love my sons, and I love football. And since California is Pacific time and the games all take place earlier in the day, I won't be at church until the Sunday after Super Bowl Sunday. Oh, of course I would see Frank in the building, just not on Sunday. His beloved wife was my secretary, after all, and he faithfully came to religious education meetings in the evening. But never on Sunday did he come to worship, until the week after Super Bowl, and all because of love. Now, you can tell me if you want that love of spouse and love of football are not the same thing. You can't love a sporting event like you love a person. It's just different. Well, maybe it is, and maybe it isn't. You see, love is the largest, most diverse word in the English language. And so far, I have not met anyone who insists that love has one and one meaning only. Love works perfectly well in many kinds of sentences that we use with each other daily. It works very well, for example, in the sentence, "I love chocolate." And when I told you last year that I loved every minute of my time in Berlin, Germany, I meant it. I didn't just like every minute, I loved every minute. In a similar way, John Updike uses the word love quite honestly and accurately in describing his hometown in Pennsylvania. "I loved this plain street where for 13 years no great harm had been allowed to befall me. I loved Shillington, not as one loves Capri or New York because they are special, but as one loves one's own body and consciousness, because they are synonymous with being. It was exciting for me to be in Shillington, as if my life, like the expanding universe when projected backward, gained heat and intensity. If there was a meaning to existence, I was closest to it here." What a beautiful set of words to attach to the word love. Meaning, exciting, expanding, heat, intensity. Makes sense to me. That's exactly what I meant when I told you I loved being in Berlin. And the word love works equally well in grand sentences, like those of Mahatma Gandhi and St. John the Divine, respectively. Love is God. God is love. And I say with complete honesty, I love my friends, all of them, each in different ways, to be sure. And I loved my grandparents when they were alive, but also each of them in different ways. And my love for them hasn't abated, even though they've died, for their smiling, tender images still rest in my heart. But I certainly love my grandmother Anna in a very different way from my grandmother Carmelina. But both ways, fell into my larger definition of love. My love for my sister Lynn has always been there. She is an amazing person. But in these last 5 weeks, my love for her has grown, my respect deepened, as I watch how beautifully she has handled all the difficult work around my brother, who has been in the psych ward of a suburban Detroit hospital for a week now, after being in another wing of that hospital for 4 weeks. This has been difficult work, all the talk with social workers and psychologists. And she has been suffering painful shingles for a few weeks now during all of this work. But her clarity and her wisdom have been matchless throughout it all. Was my love for her 20 or 30 years ago not love enough, or some more flimsy love? No, but the love I feel for her now is deeper and enriched by all sorts of other emotions: admiration, pride, esteem, and with the conversations, the long, boisterous conversations of 30 years. Now, we haven't always gotten along on every issue or shared agreement on things political or religious. But disagreements have never been an obstacle for me to love my sister. For me, at least, such things simply go hand in hand with love. As our children's story from the Congo made so movingly clear this morning, after every disagreement, you can always go down to the river, after all, and wash the leaves. But there are indeed obstacles to love in our lives. And I propose this morning that those obstacles are entirely within ourselves. Great blocks, solid as rock, blocking our path. Some of you may have read the New York Times bestseller, The Five Love Languages, by Gary Chapman. He's a popular evangelical Christian writer that somehow crosses the boundaries of religion and irreligion pretty well. He suggests that there are five love languages that we all speak. Not each of us speaking all five, mind you, but each of us speaking one of five love languages, or maybe two or three. Right off the bat, when I read his list, I decided I could name a dozen more pretty easily. But for the sake of my argument this morning, I'll stick to his five. And we'll stick to love of people this morning, mostly couples, different sex or same sex, makes no difference. But perhaps we can rope best friends into this too, fellow congregants, and even our children. After all, it's pretty easy to make a case that it's less important whether you love Berlin or chocolate than whether or not you can love the significant people in your life. Chapman's five love languages are as follows. One, spending quality time together regularly, which I think is pretty much self-defining. Two, words of affirmation. I love you, for example. Or simple praise, such as, you're so beautiful, you know. Or, I really get a kick of how much joy you seem to take in paying bills and balancing checkbooks. That kind of stuff just drives me crazy, but it really puts a kick in your step, and I love that. Three, gifts. Flowers on a Wednesday afternoon for no reason, yes, but little cards with messages tucked into the pillow at night, a special shirt perhaps with a bright color, a tape of wonderful songs that you've put together. Four, acts of service. Service like my grandmother cooking the foods I loved above all else every time I saw her. Or maybe your roommate or your spouse ironing your blouse or your shirt just because. And five, physical touch. Not sex, mind you, in any of its ordinary meanings, but cuddling on the couch, a hug at 3 o'clock in the afternoon for no particular reason, holding hands perhaps while watching a movie, wiping a brow, laying your head on a welcoming lap. Chapman says we imagine that our love is not working right, or that it's broken, or that it's ebbing, or that it's blocked, when we don't find that the language of love we use is either spoken or even understood by the other person. A person who is sure that love means a confession of love verbally, in English, I love you, will not understand an act of service, setting the table, then doing the dishes just because, as love. They'll only see it as, well, it's about time kind of duty. A person who thinks that love is flowers or a special meal of well-loved dishes on Thursday evening may be annoyed by physical touch, thinking that physical touch is just so much manipulative grasping and clutching without the flowers to bless it first. In short, and we'll use a language metaphor here, someone fluent in French and only French cannot expect to understand someone who is fluent only in Japanese. And someone fluent and settled on one love language is just not necessarily going to understand anyone who conceives of love in a totally different way. To be sure, keeping with the linguistic metaphor, many people are multilingual, but many more are not. They are being loved, but they don't feel they are being loved, since they speak a different dialect. However, it seems to me that it's the fixed image of love that's the problem here. The fixed image of love we've accepted inside of ourselves. And I pointed out at the beginning that most people that I know use the word very broadly, that is, with generous meanings and varying spins. I love you. I love Berlin. I love chocolate. Love is God. So on one level, we already know that love has many images, many uses, many more uses, in fact, than Chapman portrays. But on another level, we may each feel deep down that one image of love is, after all, authentically better and more real than others. Real love is gifts, or real love is praise. And the other person just ought to know that. But to assume that our understanding of real love is, or worse, should be, everyone else's preferred definition of love is sadly self-serving. When we Unitarian Universalists lift up, as we do in our principles, the inherent worth and dignity of every person, we are not in any way saying the inherent sameness of all humanity. It's the differences that we're called to affirm as inherently worthy more than our similarities. Although I'm convinced I myself generally speak two of these love languages more often than not, I have suffered myself many blocks to my expressions of love and my reception of love. Sometimes I block love coming my way by thinking myself completely unworthy of that love. It's a sudden and complete and full pushback. Sometimes I block giving love out of fear of losing myself in its larger-than-life energy. And many times I have blocked love because all of my images of love tend to be anger-free, tender, and welcoming, with lots of light rays coming out of them. But love, as Florida Scott Maxwell reminds us at the top of the order of celebration, can sear as well as heal, can devastate as well as apply soothing balm. So because I've been coming up on this month of sermons on love, I've been paying attention these last weeks to how often and when I have used the word love in my life, in my conversations, my affirmations, my emails, anytime I use it. And as I was working on this sermon, I remembered a story I told at a meeting last Saturday when Joan Van Beesler, our district executive, led a very fine workshop on leadership issues for congregations with some of the leaders here in the church, mostly board members. I told then the story about a man in my former congregation, another man, not Frank Perry, but another one, a pillar of the church, beloved and esteemed by everyone, one of the founding members, in fact. He was an amazing man in so many ways, I can't count them. For example, once when he was at a prestigious lecture over in San Francisco, where a pretty famous politician was describing how evil the Soviets were, how monstrous and degenerate their system was, and how worthless their brainwashed people were, this man raised his hand and, when called upon, asked the speaker, "If what you say is true, all those words about evil and degeneracy, then when do we start bombing them out of existence?" The man was shocked, started backtracking immediately. But lost the audience completely just because of what this man said, showing forth the truth of the vile language. I came to realize in my first couple of years that he was not only smart, but pretty wise about specifically church things. He had been raised a Methodist and had learned methodical ways of dealing with every church issue imaginable, and he was usually right. But, as these things go, he also drank four glasses, big glasses of gin, every night before supper. And then he would come to church meetings. His tongue, loosed by the gin, He would slice and dice people with it, primarily using sarcasm, getting them to do all the things the way he thought they should be done. Because he was so revered, no one dared to contradict him, even though they felt hurt by his barbs. Without gin in him, he was as sweet as could be. With gin, totally outrageous. Afterward, he would come up the next day, usually, come up the driveway, come to my office, and apologize to me for being so mean at the meetings. He'd lope up the driveway and express sincere sorrow for how he had abused his fellow congregants. "I don't know why I do it," he says. As a young, naive minister, I always heard him out, counseled him to be more careful, and found that his lovable self always won me over. But then I realized what he was doing was a constant, that it happened habitually, that he couldn't be careful because he was bursting with gin. So one day I realized that although I loved the church very much, and I loved him, and I loved myself, that some things had to change, and that one of us was going to lose. I knew that all by himself, he had the power to move me out of my ministry. He was that powerful. So I was scared and terrified, and I was very upset. But I decided that my problem was that love was an image of anger-free, tender, and welcoming light for me. And that for me to love him the way I really needed to love him, I couldn't have that image anymore. So one day, after one of these incidents, he came up the driveway to tell me he was sorry. And I said, "Apology not accepted." He looked stunned. And then I said with a clarity and forcefulness that surprised me, I wasn't even sure where it was coming from, I called him by his name, and then I said to him, "If you ever do what you did again, what you did last night, ever again, coming to a meeting with alcohol on your breath, ready to slice and dice with your very potent sarcasm, then I swear to you right now, I will pick you up in my arms, I will throw you into my car, I will drive you to your house, and I will put you down on your front steps. You may not come to the church intoxicated anymore and hurt people." Immediately his face turned this color, and he couldn't speak. He got up, and he left in a huff. My knees were knocking, and I was really scared. But he came to service every Sunday after that. Didn't speak to me, but he showed up and seemed like he was okay. After 3 weeks, he acted as if I hadn't said anything to him, and we began to enjoy each other's company at meetings. But he never again came to church with gin on his breath. And as time went on, I came to love him more and more because he did that, and for his wisdom and his real care for the congregation, his ethical courage, and his willingness to learn new things. And I could tell that he loved me very much. And by the time I left, many years later, I loved him very much, and I always looked forward to our conversations. And he told me just the day before I left that he knew how much I loved him because of what I said to him on that day. And you could hear the quotation marks when he said it. What I learned on that day, at least rudimentarily, was that love is not always anger-free, tender, and welcoming with light rays all around it. In fact, it can't be easily defined at all or confined to any fixed image or even 5 images or 12 or 32. As a matter of fact, fixed images, as we know from our Hebrew ancestors in the Hebrew scriptures, fixed images are dead. They're not alive. What's alive moves. What's alive grows and stretches. And that's precisely why I like Natalie Goldberg's passage so much. She reminds us of that with great skill. Remember, she's a young person in ninth grade. She's already confining herself at that early age into a fixed image, a frozen stance. She's afraid, she says, and she wants to be in control. Her words, "In those days, I was watching my step, making sure I knew all the rules, keeping things in control. I never felt that I fit in. For fear that people would think I was weird, I saw no one around me I could identify with. I tried not to be noticed. I became a nerd." But she had a teacher, Mr. Clemente. "Thank God for that rain outside the window and for Mr. Clemente," she writes, "who allowed us in ninth grade to listen to it for no reason in the middle of the day. That one moment carried me a long way into my life because Mr. Clemente asked me to listen to the rain, to connect a sense organ with something natural and neutral and good. He asked me to become alive. I was scared. And I loved it. I loved it," she concludes. She learned to love being alive and that fear. Listening to the rain, something sensual and moving, and not to the stiff voices inside of her, telling her to shut herself up in a shell against all the fears prompted by relationships and an open and vulnerable heart. Obstacles on the path to love are many. Lack of self-worth, fear, pride, as perhaps in the story this morning, bad experience with love in the past, many things. But mostly the obstacles are the images we keep inside ourselves, in the fixed ideas we each might have of what love really means. They become hard and rigid if we universalize our own personal image and apply it to everyone else in our life. This being so, it's time to open ourselves up to Mr. Clemente as our teacher, as did Natalie Goldberg, asking ourselves in his voice to remember to regard the world, not images of the world, to let our love be fluid and alive, not a fixed image of something romantic, flawless, and perhaps controlling. In fact, we can be, in the words of Philip Reeve, the great sociologist, fellow teachers, Mr. Clemente's to each other, inviting each other to speak new languages of love, alive, fresh, afire, and perhaps a bit risky and fearful at first. But we can do that. So, love the Super Bowl, if that's your thing. Love it with a passion. Visit Capri, New York, or Berlin, or your hometown, and exclaim, "Nibble chocolate and melt away. Proclaim love divine with joy." But most of all, turn to those you love and listen to them as Natalie Goldberg listened to the rain and hear, perhaps, words in a language you didn't know that you already knew how to speak.